That's it. Game over. The drought is over. The U.S. wins the 2015 Women's World Cup.
Ah, I tell you what, when it comes to soccer in this country, I think the most exciting games and the most exciting, the most national excitement over soccer came from our women's teams. The U.S. women's national soccer team actually went from not existing in the early 80s to winning world championships and Olympic gold. And we're going to be talking to the author of a new book about how they got there, and we'll learn how they changed women's sports. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. And really pleased to have with us Caitlin Murray. She's written about soccer for the New York Times, ESPN, Fox, and Yahoo Sports. She was also the Guardian's correspondent during those 2015 World Cup matches and followed the U.S. team on their path to victory. Her new book is called The National Team, The Inside Story of the Women Who Changed Soccer. So, did you play soccer when you were growing up, or do you have some kids playing now? How did the national team affect you as you watch that team play? Do you follow women's soccer? We'd love to hear from you. I hope you'll join in the conversation. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin Murray, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I tell you what, it was really a joy for me to, and kind of sad sometimes, to read parts of your book, The National Team. I have a daughter who loves soccer and plays on her high school soccer team, and I have my niece plays on the U.S. National 17-under team right now, Talia Stouty. And so I've had a interest in soccer for quite a while. And you were a player yourself, were you not?
Well, I am a female in the United States, so I like all girls growing up, I played soccer, but I was definitely not aiming for a spot on the national team. I was not good enough. I am much better at writing about it.
what made you decide to become a sports writer?
Honestly, just the fact that I love soccer. I mean, my background is in journalism. I'm originally from Buffalo, New York. And I covered education for the Buffalo News, and my background is in news journalism. But soccer is really fun and exciting, and I thought it would be cool if I kind of pivoted and, you know, started writing about it professionally.
You know, it's really, I think probably pretty much everybody listening today has grown, and this is interesting because you've got a kind of a history book here, but we were all living when soccer got going in this country because it started in the early 1980s.
Well, yeah, at least women's soccer for the
right.
Women's national team didn't start until 1985. And it's pretty impressive how they established their dominance so early in the program, and they've just continued that ever since. The culture and the mentality that they created in the 80s is exactly what we still see in the team today. It's what the players still talk about, the culture that was set by the players that came before them. So it's been a meteoric rise, I guess, for the U.S. women's national team.
You know, you saw way early in the book, you mentioned Title IX, and it was interesting to me, the story of getting it, Title IX, passed, and there had to be a little bit of subterfuge in a way, wasn't there?
Yeah, so Title IX it's just a very short language. It's one sentence, 37 words, that essentially says schools that get federal funding cannot discriminate on the basis of gender. And that was written, I think, probably to be about academics, but it translated to all programming at universities, and that included scholarships and athletics and, you know, having scholarships for women to play soccer and other sports be available. And one of the architects of the bill was a congresswoman named Edith Green, and she knew that if people knew or were aware that this was going to create equality in sports, that people were going to be against it. So when people who supported the bill wanted to lobby for the bill and talk about it, she waved them off. She said, no, 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 we don't want people to know what this is going to do. They're going to ask too many questions if you talk about it. So let's just slip this under the radar. And thank goodness she did, because it completely changed sports in this country. It created a huge incentive. Now, suddenly, little girls had a reason to really take sports seriously. They could win a scholarship that's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars if they play well. And then when they get to those schools, they're going to be in these competitive environments where they're competing day in and day out. If it wasn't for Title IX, the U.S. women's national team wouldn't be so dominant, because there's nothing like Title IX around the world.
Yeah, it just absolutely amazing story. And I, you know, I've got daughters, so it's to me, I am so happy for, selfishly sometimes so happy for Title IX, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, sports is an important part of, you know, young people's lives, and like learning how to work within a team, and, you know, learning how to be competitive. Those are really important things. And it's important that girls have that. It's certainly not something that only boys are going to benefit from.
Well, I was flabbergasted, frankly, when I read in your book about the first the circumstances around the first team. What were those circumstances like?
Well, I mean, it all sort of came together a little bit accidentally. You know, there was this sports festival that existed in the United States, and they added women's soccer to that. So once that happened, the U.S. Soccer Federation got an invitation to have a team compete in Italy for this women's soccer tournament. And the U.S. didn't really have a national team, so they just kind of picked some random players from this event, this mini Olympics that was held in Baton Rouge. And this mishmash of players had uniforms that were just sort of like whatever was left in the warehouse, they joked. None of it fit. Before they went to Italy the night before, the training staff was working with the players to sew the uniforms and cut them so they would actually fit, because they were huge. They were clearly men's sizes. They were not red, white, and blue. They didn't have, you know, the players' names on the back. It was just very, they were a ragtag bunch. But, you know, they were thrilled at the time to, you know, just be getting to go to Italy. It's certainly very different now. You know, they weren't paid anything. It was just kind of, well, I don't know what this is, but sure, I'll say yes. I'll go along with it.
And they did pretty well.
Well, the first tournament, they did not do well. They were pretty bad. However, after they got past that,
yeah,
they brought in a new coach, Anson Dorrance, who went on to coach the national team for a number of years. He is currently the coach at UNC, and he has won a ton of championships. And once he got in there, he helped sort of establish this winning mentality and this fight that we still see in the team today. Players still talk about how that is the culture of the team. And that kind of started, I think, when Anson Dorrance came in, because he kind of knew what he kind of knew what he was doing. He had coached college soccer for a while.
And he was the, if I'm not mistaken, the longest serving coach. I think it was like 8 years, wasn't he? Something like that.
Ooh, I'm trying to
Maybe 1986 to 1994, which I think most of the other coaches over time were somewhere between a year or two.
Yeah, the team cycles through coaches a lot. And as I talk about in my book, usually it's because the players have formed a mutiny and gotten the coach fired. But I mean, that's part of, you know, the mentality we talk about with the team. They are winners. They will stop at nothing to win. And, you know, they will voice if they have concerns about the coaching, and they have done that over and over again over the years.
That was so fascinating to me to read about this. Well, I was actually, it was a funny story in there somewhere where you're talking about those, that early team where one of the shortest girls, they had to go by the number of the men's uniform.
Right. Yeah.
So here's this really short girl, and she's got this really tall guy that was also a number three.
Yeah. So you're talking about Shannon Higgins. She was number three. The way she described herself was 5 foot something, 120 pounds. And John Doyle, the number three on the men's side, he was 6 foot three and a 200 plus pound giant. And the women didn't have their own uniforms back in, you know, the early 90s. So she had to wear the secondhand uniform from John Doyle, and it was massive. But she had to just make it work and, you know, play
it. She made it work. Noah in Middleton, let's give you a chance to join in. Hi, Noah.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm really enjoying this right now. I was just thinking about this last night. I was watching some playoff hockey, and there was analysis and commentary provided by both men and women, which I'm finding more common in all sports, and I've really just enjoyed the sort of diversification of that voice in sports broadcasting.
Yeah, I think especially in women's soccer. Women's soccer and men's soccer is exactly the same. I know that in some sports there's an excuse that softball isn't the same as baseball, or, you know, whatever people want to say, which, you know, may or may not have merit. But I think the interesting thing about soccer is that it is exactly the same sport. The dimensions are the same. The play is the same. I mean, what are the things we love in soccer? Things like bicycle kicks, things like performing skills like, nutmegs or whatever. All of that can be played in women's soccer. And it's interesting. Allie Wagner is a player who was on the U.S. women's national team. She was Fox Sports' one of their lead broadcasters during the Men's World Cup last year, which is really cool to see. We are seeing it, you know, in basketball, hockey, other sports more. Allie Wagner last year sort of broke the mold in soccer, too. And it's great to see that we're moving in that direction.
Yeah, and they've done a really good job, too, by the way, of it. Well, Noah, thank you so much for calling. I want to take your call, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. This is a great new book. It's called The National Team, The Inside Story of the Women Who Changed Soccer. And the author is our guest today, Caitlin Murray. I'm going to be purchasing a couple of extra copies to pass on to some of my female, daughter and niece and so forth. And she's going to be with us, by the way, till 12:30. We'll be back after the news, so stay with us. Talking about the history of the U.S. women's national soccer team today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Caitlin Murray, written about soccer for the New York Times, ESPN, Fox Sports, Yahoo Sports. She was also the Guardian's correspondent during the 2015 World Cup, followed the U.S. team on its path to victory. So we're talking about her new book. It's a dandy. It's called The National Team, The Inside Story of the Women Who Changed Soccer. Are you a women's soccer fan? What do you feel about the game? What do you like about the game? Give us a call with your questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Caitlin, caller online, Fawn from Madison. So let's go to her next. Fawn, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I'm grateful for Title IX because when I was in high school in the 1980s, I was one of a handful of girls who actually used that to break into the boys' soccer team. Our school had a boys' soccer team, but no girls' soccer team. And we, there's like four or five of us that were really dead set on playing soccer. And with the, after a whole lot of discussion with the grown-ups, we were finally allowed to play on the boys' team, which was quite a challenge, but it was one of the greatest experiences for me. And then the following year, they created a girls' team. So I'm grateful for that opportunity. And to this day, I love playing soccer, although I must say my skill is not quite up to par with my World Cup dreams.
Caitlin,
yeah, I mean, when,
go ahead, Caitlin.
When Title IX, was passed, I think I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think it was about 100,000 female soccer players registered in the United States. Today, that number is in the multiples of millions, and it can all be. So there are a lot of young girls like you that took up soccer after Title IX and changed sports in the United States.
Really, really did. Thank you, Fawn, very much for calling. You know, just a little bit more history here. How did this relatively new team manage to win the first World Cup in 1991?
Yeah, so I spoke to players about that. You know, how were you able to win the first World Cup when, you know, other countries, women's soccer was very young at the time. So it's not as if other countries were well ahead of the U.S. in terms of the investment they were getting and the resources that they had. But the difference, I think, for these other countries was, you know, you look at countries like Italy or, you know, Sweden or Denmark, or, you know, soccer is a big part of the culture there, and it has been for a long time. In the United States in 1991, you know, soccer barely was on the map. I mean, MLS didn't even exist yet, the men's league. There hadn't been any World Cups here yet. So when I asked the players, how were you able to do it? They said, you know, the other teams were more technically skilled than us. They were better than us. But what we had was a mental edge. We kept fighting and clawing in a way that other teams just weren't quite prepared for. And it was interesting to hear the players say that because, you know, as the team has evolved and we've gotten to where the team is at now, it's the same thing. It's that mentality. I mean, the best memories I have of watching the U.S. women's national team is when their backs are up against the wall, when they're behind and you think it's over for them. You know, a specific example that some of your listeners might remember, in 2011, the U.S. was down against Brazil. Yeah. There were some terrible calls by the referee. Yeah. It really seemed like it was over and Marta was going to come in and, you know, steamroll past the U.S. And there was that goal, Megan Rapinoe crosses the ball to Abby Wambach, latest goal in World Cup history, men's or women's. That's the U.S. They just keep fighting until the very last second. And that was why they won in 91. That's why they've had the continued success that they've had over the years.
Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Thanks for calling, Nick.
Hi, I've got... I don't mean to be offensive. I got no interest in soccer whatsoever. I don't know anything about it, but my daughter tried it and she loves it. And I keep encouraging her, saying that she could probably get a free ride to college if she actually like pursues it. And the coach on one day on the sidelines told me, like, you know, your daughter's got quite the leg on her. Can she actually get a free tuition paid for playing soccer?
Are there scholarships for soccer? Yes, indeed there are, Caitlin, aren't there?
Well, yeah, there are lots of them. In fact, just about every player that has come through the U.S. women's national team over the years started in college soccer. That's where they developed and became the players that they are. There are a few instances, you know, where the players were teenagers and maybe they were coming out of high school. But college soccer is huge in this country. I mean, it's just absolutely massive. There are tons of scholarships available. So, yes, your daughter should absolutely stick to it. because I know that that is a lot of money for parents to pay. So you should definitely encourage her. She can get a scholarship for sure.
My niece, Talia, who's on the U.S. Under-17 national team, I mentioned that earlier, will be going to Virginia, University of Virginia, on a scholarship next. So I know firsthand there are scholarships out there. And it indeed is helpful, for sure, to be on a scholarship. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it. I want to go to, you know, what really bothered me the most in reading your book, it's kind of frustrated me no end, was the lack of support for the women's soccer as opposed to the men's.
Mm-hmm.
It could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's an issue we're still dealing with today.
Yeah.
Last month, the players sued the U.S. Soccer Federation.
Right.
They sued their boss, alleging institutionalized gender discrimination. And there is absolutely no doubt that it has gotten better. And I don't think there is any arguing in 2019 that U.S. soccer does not value the U.S. women's national team and does not see them as a vital part of the federation and soccer in this country. There was a time, you know, when the team first started that, you know, I don't think the federation quite knew what to do with the women's team, or I certainly don't think they had the vision for what the U.S. women's national team would become. And I mean, there was a time where the women were getting $10 per day per diem, and that was all that they got. They did not get any other compensation. The men's team got $25 per diem. The women were taking, you know, hotel shuttle vans to their games, and the men, you know, had the luxury buses that you see sports teams travel in. The women were in middle seats, and you know, the women were getting meals at between training sessions while the men's practices were catered. I mean, that was just how it was in the early 90s. And if it wasn't for those players on those early teams who decided to stand up and ask for more and push against U.S. soccer and demand to be treated better, you know, I don't know how much progress there would have been. You know, it's really a credit to the team that they felt that they should fight and demand for more. And we're still seeing that today. It's an ongoing conversation. I'm very interested to see what is going to happen with this lawsuit that was filed. But it's definitely not an issue that has gone away. That's for sure.
I was, as you were talking, I was thinking to what you were writing about regarding the World Cup in 99, when before the World Cup, the Federation really didn't want to spend a lot of money to promote it.
Yeah, it's U.S. soccer and FIFA. FIFA is the governing body of soccer in the world. Everyone had sort of low expectations. They didn't think that anyone was going to show up for a Women's World Cup. And FIFA felt that the game should be held in very small stadiums. They should all be on the East Coast. And the players and the organizers of the World Cup felt that was totally wrong. They wanted to make the event as big as possible, put it in the biggest stadiums, put it across the country. And they had like no marketing budget because FIFA wasn't willing to provide any sort of support. And so the players took it upon themselves to market the Women's World Cup. The players of the U.S. Women's National Team were, you know, at any city that was hosting a World Cup game in 99, in the months beforehand, those players were at soccer clinics and youth camps and schools and wherever they could find kids who played soccer to let them know, hey, the World Cup is coming. Have your parents take you. And that's sort of a remarkable thing. It's sort of like, I don't know, Tom Brady stumping to get people to the Super Bowl or something. But these players wanted it to be such a success that it was, you know, it was this grassroots sort of door-to-door salesman sort of thing. And it worked. The Women's World Cup in 1999 was huge. And to this day, the crowd that they got at the Rose Bowl, over 90,000 people, is a record in women's soccer.
It was amazing. Well, talk about New York. When the players were trying to get to the stadium.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So that's actually, the prologue, of the book, if you know, people want to read it. So the players, you know, before every game, they would get on their bus, drive to the stadium together, you know, a few hours before a game. And on this particular day, there was a lot of traffic, and the players were really worried that they were going to be late for the first game of the 1999 Women's World Cup. And, you know, they were saying to themselves, what's going on? Like, where is all this traffic coming from? Is something going on in New York City and it's backed up into the turnpike in New Jersey? Like, what's going on? And then, you know, as the ride continues a little more, the players start to notice that all these cars that are blocking them and clogging up the highway say things like "Go USA," have, you know, red, white, and blue painted on the windows. It's people who are going to the stadium to see them. And the players were just completely blown away by that. They couldn't believe that this many people were going to watch them, because, you know, only a few years earlier, they were playing in high school stadiums and they weren't even selling out. So when they realized these people were there to see them, it kind of took their breath away. And, you know, when they got to the stadium, they were taking pictures of people who were taking pictures of them because it was such a weird thing. Yeah, and, you know, the players say that's really the moment they realize that the 1999 Women's World Cup was going to be a big deal.
And you even talk about them running out through the darkened tunnel and into the stadium, and, you know, it's coming to tears almost at what they saw. They'd never seen anything like it in terms of people.
There's no question that the 1999 Women's World Cup, and, you know, that's the one where Brandi Chastain scores the penalty kick and she rips her shirt off, and that's the cover of Sports Illustrated, which I think is still one of the most iconic images in sports. That tournament is really the changing point for women's soccer in this country. And it certainly wasn't a straight line to get to where we are now, where I would say the players on the U.S. women's national team, some of them are bona fide celebrities. They get these huge crowds for their games. You know, they're famous. They make a lot of money. It was not a straight line to get there from the 99 World Cup, but it certainly started there.
Yeah, it did. And Brandi taking off her top and just with a sports bra, that even resulted in a big discussion of sexuality and so forth in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, so I was a small child when all of this happened, so I wasn't really aware of the coverage. And, you know, being in 2019 and, you know, the way that the team is covered and talked about is so different now. You know, I was at the 2015 World Cup in Canada, and the discussion there was about the tactics. Is Coach Jill Ellis, you know, putting the players in the right formation? Is she starting the right lineup? It's actually about the soccer. Whereas in 1999, it was how attractive the players were. You know, there were newspaper headlines that referred to them as babes and talked about sex appeal and how that was driving the team forward. And it was honestly sort of shocking to me to see how the women's team was covered and talked about back then. It was very unabashed in kind of reducing the players to these sex symbols instead of talking about them as athletes, instead of talking about, you know, the tactics or the skills or, you know, the athleticism. So, you know, as much as we have work to do, it's clear to me that we have come a long way.
Yeah. Irene in Phillips, Wisconsin. We'll go to you next. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. What a great program. I'll never forget July 10th, 1999, because my son got married that day. There were hundreds of people in the church. The minister interrupted the service, the wedding ceremony, to let us all know that the women had just defeated China.
Was there a big cheer, Irene?
No, actually, the church was pretty quiet, but we'll all remember that.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for calling. Well, that team.
The priest was a big fan.
That team, it really did result in a change in, I think, certainly that's the sexuality part of it. All right. Maybe that was the beginning of an evolution. But that 99 World Cup really, I thought, had a huge impact on women in sports.
Yeah, absolutely. There are studies that U.S. Soccer has done that in the cities that hosted the 1999 Women's World Cup, the amount of young girls who registered and started playing soccer just skyrocketed. I mean, the impact from a World Cup and seeing the U.S. win, seeing the U.S. play on home soil, I mean, the impact of that is huge and can't be ignored. I mean, just the fact that the World Cup was there probably change sports in ways that, you know, we don't even necessarily know. I mean, so many players on the team right now, you ask them about 1999, and a lot of them were actually there, attended games during the 99 World Cup, and it touched them, and it inspired them to say, I want to do that one day. I want to be on the U.S. Women's National Team.
This is something I often wondered, I'm really glad to read your book because I now have a much better handle on this. But you look at the women's team and its monumental successes over the years, despite a lot of handicaps, they still have had to battle for equality with the men's team, which has never done as well.
Yeah, it's certainly for people who follow the U.S. Women's National Team and have seen them win World Cups, it's definitely confusing because the U.S. women win. They bring a lot of glory to the United States and the U.S. Soccer Federation. The men's team did not even qualify for the last World Cup. In the past, U.S. Soccer has pointed out that the men's team brings in more revenue. And that has been true in the past. It's not a consistent thing. It kind of depends. Okay, if the men had a World Cup, they bring in more money that year. When the women have a World Cup, they bring in more money that year. But over the course of a four-year cycle, the men used to bring in more money than the women. But for the last 3 years, the women have brought in more money, and this year they will again. So it'll be a full cycle where for every year, the women have brought in more money. So that is changing, and it puts more pressure on U.S. soccer and makes it much harder for them to justify any sort of differences in the way that they treat the women's team, in the way that they compensate the women's team. And I think we can continue to see this shifting because the U.S. women are only getting more popular. They're only, you know, we'll see how they do in France this summer at the World Cup. I'm a little bit nervous. It's a very tough field that they have at the World Cup. But I think it's only going to become a stronger argument for the women that it's completely unjustifiable for U.S. soccer to treat them any differently than the men's team.
Well, there are some wonderful stories that you tell about many of the players on that team. There were a lot of really strong-minded women on that team and on those teams, and they've had a huge impact on kind of the way soccer has gone and the way people in this country and elsewhere view soccer, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite stories in the book is Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy were sitting in a conference room with Bob Consigliere, who was the president of U.S. Soccer. And Mia Hamm looked him right in the eyes and said, "I am going to never play soccer again if you don't treat us better. I'm happy to quit. I've won a gold medal. I won a World Cup. I have no problem walking away." Julie Foudy chimes in, "Oh, yeah. I mean, I can call it a career. I've gotten everything that I need to win. You know, there's no problem with that. I don't need to put up with this." And, you know, I don't know that Bob Consigliere knew quite what to say to that.
It's a great story.
It's just fascinating to me that these players were so willing to kind of put themselves on the line and stand up so bluntly to the people who really decided whether they would continue to have careers or not. It's incredibly impressive. And, you know, I think
it's wonderful. We are out of time. Oh, my goodness. I wish we had more time, Caitlin, because I want to mention the title of your book again, The National Team, The Inside Story of the Women Who Changed Soccer. Caitlin Murray, our guest today. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us today. And for you listening, thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.